Welcome to this edition of the Disciples Men podcast with your hosts Greg Alexander and Alex Ruth. Thank you for joining us as we explore the many challenges of being man of faith in these challenging times. Disciples Men is a ministry of Disciples Home Missions of the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ in the U.S. and Canada. Let's listen in today's conversation.
Welcome to another edition of the Disciples Men podcast. Alex Ruth, your Associate Director of Disciples Men, with you, and a very special guest with us today, in addition to our Director of Disciples Men, Greg Alexander. And I'm going to let Greg have the honor of introducing her.
Hey, good morning, Alex, or good afternoon. It's good to see you. Always good to see you, my friend. And yes, we do have a very special guest with us, as promised. We are pleased and privileged to have the General Minister and President of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ in the United States and Canada, the Reverend Terry Horde Owens, with us today. I know from past experience that she likes to be called Terry. So we will be calling Terry, because that's what she has requested. So please don't send hate mail at us for being disrespectful to our General Minister and President, because there's nobody that respects and loves our General Minister and President more than Alex and I.
So, yeah, no doubt.
Terry, thank you for being with us today. And I'm going to let you kind of share a little bit of your journey with us, how you got here. I've heard it many times, but I don't want to mess it up. So share with us what you want us to know about Terry today.
Well, first of all, thanks, Greg and Alex, so much. It's great to connect, at least in this way, with Disciples Men. So thanks for inviting me to be part of this conversation. I guess maybe the most succinct way to describe my journey is I never expected to be here. I grew up in the Midwest in Terre Haute, Indiana, which is about 70 miles west of Indianapolis. Went to school out east, did my undergraduate work at Harvard with a double major in government, political science, and African-American studies, and went to the corporate world and worked for about 20-some years as an IT consultant, and became a senior-level executive in IT at several companies, IBM. Worked there at the early part of my career, worked a long time for the Blue Cross Blue Shield system, even spent some time at Ameritech, AT&T, and spent some time consulting with Ernst & Young. But I felt a call to ministry in my mid-30s, and it took me a couple of years to get to seminary, moved to Chicago. So I'm an alumna of the University of Chicago Divinity School and of Disciples Divinity House there, and worked that whole time. So I know what it is to be both a bivocational student, as well as became a bivocational pastor. Spent 12 years as the dean of students at the Divinity School, and during that time pastored a disciples congregation in the western suburbs of Chicago. And people started talking to me when it was known that Sharon was reaching the end of her term limit, and I feel like I was drafted. There were a lot of people who said, you should think about this. Have you ever thought about this? And it was sort of an evolution, almost a groundswell of people approaching me about it. And I never had a lot of anxiety about the process because I loved what I was doing. I loved being at the Divinity School. I loved my congregation. And I was like, well, God, if this is what you have for me, this is what will be. And if not, I'm quite content to be where I am. So I couldn't be more honored and thrilled, really, even in these challenging times, to be your general minister and president. But I'm a bivocational person and also have an IT background, which gives me a unique spin on a lot of things. So I've led large organizations, I've managed large budgets, I've lived through corporate mergers and all kinds of stuff. So this is what I bring, but I have a great love for the church. And this is actually the first time in my career that I've worked full time for the church. I've always been bivocational before this. So that's a new experience for me too. I never actually thought I would get to a point where I could be fully employed by the church, and here I am. So I'm grateful for that.
We are very grateful for that too, Terry. And you and I have had the privilege to work together some since you started. And I've said many times to people that every time I'm with you, I think I can't get more impressed with who you are, and I always walk away more impressed. And and that's from the bottom of my heart. It's absolutely true.
Thanks, Greg. You're so
kind. You're welcome. You've sort of inherited a mess we knew coming into the church that the church had issues, that, you know, structurally that we've had some things we need to deal with. So again, while you may not have known everything, you had some awareness of that. Over the last several weeks, we have seen the social unrest that I personally haven't seen since I was a marcher in the anti-Vietnam War protests when I was younger. And now we're seeing some extremely challenging moments for us as a nation. I guess I would ask, how are you seeing the church's role in this? You're sending out regular statements to us as a church, which I know I appreciate. Alex does. You know, I'm sure the church is very appreciative of that coming and wise way you've been speaking to us. But, you know, as a faith community, we should have a voice in this in some way. And I'm just kind of curious as to what you see and what you would encourage us to embrace moving forward.
I totally agree, Greg. The church must have a voice and should speak. When we first moved into sort of remote working at the beginning of the pandemic, there are several leaders, regional ministers, local pastors. I think we all recognize that as much as we had to scramble to adapt to initially just worship, right? How do we worship from afar online, and people who maybe had not had a proclivity toward that kind of work before found it within themselves, right, to learn and adapt. And people who had the knowledge and even the equipment were reaching out to work together. And so I've seen a real spirit of collaboration across the regions, across the general ministries in this first bit of disruption called COVID-19 that gives me great hope that we will emerge from all of this as a different church. We have no choice at this point. My State of the Church speech at the General Board meeting in February used the language of Walter Brueggemann, prophetic imagination. And mm-hmm. I said, I pray that the church would have the courage to imagine itself showing up, not just as new church, but imagining the new world and how we would be in that new world, and having the courage both to imagine, but the permission to change, giving ourselves the permission to change. I had always heard, oh, well, you know, don't try that because people will be resistant to that. And don't try this because, you know, people will be resistant. But our documents and Jesus himself give us a lot of permission to make things happen differently. From Jesus's parables were always ways to describe the kingdom of God in a way that was contrary to what people knew at the time. He would say, it is written X, but I say unto you Y. And so he was always giving us a shift in his language. And the design, for example, gives us a shift, not just in structures, but in terms of processes and how we envision ministry and church. We've already had that, but we need to give ourselves permission to change, and then freedom from fear, to let go of that fear that comes from, well, gee, if we do it that way, if we change that, what will happen? This is all I've ever known. What will happen? New voices, new stories that need to be a part of our church's life. And over the past few weeks since the murder of George Floyd, I've been, as you know, just calling the church to remember. We say we are a pro-reconciliation, anti-racist church. So what does that mean? It has to mean more than just doing anti-racism training every 2 to 3 years. It has to be more than just giving money to reconciliation ministry once a year and then doling out what is in reality not a whole lot of money, given the fact that we say this is our priority. Right. But we really have to, I think, call ourselves to action in some important ways. We've been spending some time with a scholar named David Anderson Hooker, who teaches at the Kroc Institute for Peace Studies at Notre Dame, University of Notre Dame. And he's done a lot of work on anti-racism. But one of the things that his work calls us to is to say, well, gee, disciples, when you said you were going to be a pro-reconciliation, anti-racism church, did you ever have a narrative or a vision of what the church would look like if you became that? And I don't think we ever really did. We just said, this is what we're going to do, and we know we got to educate and train. But that notion of what the church must look like. We're beginning to have conversations about that with not only the general board, the governance committee of the general board. So it's not just structural changes, it's understanding how we can impact at the tiniest piece, the most elemental piece of our church at the congregational level and the families that make up those congregations. What does it mean to be a disciple? We've really got to ask some really fundamental questions and sort of name and embrace our identity as a covenantal people, as a people that, you know, I don't like the word autonomy, but congregations are self-governing. My good friend John Imbler said to me as I took office, autonomy is a theological heresy. And so the church should never, church should never understand it that way. And I always give him credit for that, but it's real, we're self-governing. We're not floating out by ourselves. And so in this season, I think we have not only immense opportunity, but it's really a necessity for us to collaborate more, to embrace our identity. I know that there are congregations who have a chalice on their door and they have communion every Sunday, and they think that's what makes them disciple. But it's not the frequency of the communion that defines us. It's our understanding of that table as an open table, as a table that's welcome to all. That's what we broke away from the Presbyterians about, not how frequently we had communion. It's a beautiful thing. I love having communion every week. But the point is that Jesus said, this is a new covenant between God and God's creation at this table. And so every time we come, we're really reaffirming and recommitting ourselves to that covenant. So we've got to be a lot more collaborative, and we have to, and I see the regional ministers, many of whom are relatively new in their calls within the first maybe 5 to 7 years, reaching out to congregations, trying to build up those connections between congregations and region. I'm seeing in the time of COVID-19, general ministries collaborating with one another. There are general ministries who are having conversations about new ways of collaborating and doing ministry. There are regions that are saying, hey, what's the work of a region supposed to be anyway? And how can we collaborate? And at the heart of all of that is, if we are these, first of all, followers of Jesus Christ, and we believe in mission, what's the local context? And if we're really a pro-reconciling anti-racist church, we have to do more than say elect a Black woman as GMP, right? So that doesn't absolve us of any further responsibility. We have to make choices every day to do things that get us closer to being who we say we are. And I think in this moment, perhaps my job is to keep reminding us of that and ensuring that we can continue to have the conversations and just, as the Bible would say, gird up our loins and get ready to make the shifts that we really need to, make. Change is now not just a sort of a noble, romantic idea. We are in a new world. We must emerge doing things differently. And are we going to take the challenge to speak as the church must speak? COVID revealed all kinds of inequities in our world. Yes. People need health care. It's not a socialist idea to say that people need health care. And people need to not be afraid to go to the hospital or to the doctor because they're afraid they can't afford it.
Right.
That's inhumane that you would have to make those choices. And so things that we need to care about, I think we have to go beyond just preaching in our pulpits, but move beyond this notion that, oh, the church doesn't really have a responsibility there. Well, the church has a responsibility for humanity and to speak out as stewards of God's humanity and as followers of Jesus Christ, a Jesus who, you know, turned over tables in the temple, who told the religious leaders that they were like, you know, tombs full of bones, right? So pretty on the outside, but, you know, full of dead men's bones on the inside. Jesus called the church, the religious leaders of his day, called them, you know, to account. So if it's race, if it's the inequity in terms of healthcare and jobs, I think the future of our church has to be collaborative advocacy, where we are speaking out and working together to change policies and laws so that things are more humane and more just. And ecumenically, that has to follow through. So not only just calling ourselves and naming ourselves, but taking actions to help change the systems that we find ourselves in and hold our society and our elected leaders to account. We're citizens. We don't abdicate that role just because we're Christian or members of churches. And my gosh, what a sin it would be for us to not advocate for those things that Jesus calls us to in the ways in which in the U.S. in particular, we're called to. So collective advocacy, I think, has to be the end of that road.
One of the things that you've learned, I know, and certainly I learned in as a regional minister, is that, you know, our system doesn't empower us with authority.
Right.
But we can wield a lot of influence. Mm-hmm. And the tool of influence that leaders of our denomination have is the ability to call people to the table. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I have observed, I think, Terry, from, you know, again, where I am now, I have a very small glimpse of the church these days, but I do see you as someone who understands, you know, the power of getting the right people together in the right conversations. And again, not to manipulate or control the conversation, but so that the conversation, whatever conversation God wants us to have, mm-hmm. can happen in those contexts. And I have really appreciated that as a part of your ministry. And that's, you know, that is a gift. That's a tool that you can use and are using effectively for us as we all struggle with how we become an effective witness to the gospel in the times in which we live. Yeah. And I want to ask one more question. I want to move us in kind of the men's context and then turn it over to Alex. One of the things that I've known in my years, why I love men's ministry, is that men have been, since I began ministry in the late 70s, men were missing in action. You know, when I grew up, it was a male-dominated patriarchal society in the church, well, society, but in the church especially, you know, you had all the business leaders, you know, who were occupying all the important roles in the life of the church. Then the 60s came and, you know, everything changed and all of a sudden all the men disappeared. And you know, part of my ministry has been, how do we help men find a way back to church? And one of the things that Alex and I have worked on, I don't know if we've shared this with you or not, is that we felt compelled as we developed new curriculum is to start from the ground up of having conversations with all of our racial ethnic partners, with men, represented at the same table, to begin asking what should men be about together in this time and how can we create a space and create resources to inspire other men to do that. So from your perspective, where are you seeing men these days in the life of the church? Are we there? Are we still gone? Are we still MIA?
You know, I don't get to see inside congregations as much as I would like. I'm grateful for the first 2 years of my term, 2.5 years, where I've just been all over the place and spent a lot of time in regions and visiting congregations, preaching here and there. And I wouldn't say the men are missing. I still see men participating in regional leadership. I know in the congregation that I served in Downers Grove, Illinois, I had men who were more willing to cede leadership to the women that might have been the case in some situations. I had more female elders than men, but more male deacons than women. I see a lot of clergy, a lot of male clergy in this moment who are stepping up and preaching powerful sermons and organizing their communities and being out there on the wall. So I don't think it's that they're absent. I think it's younger men I'm observing see the church as a real hope for the future. The young clergy that I've met are really are not so cynical as you might think they would be about the church. When we had our General Assembly planning meeting back in January in Louisville, which seems like eons ago, I was one of the oldest people in the room, and there were only a few people in that room who were over 40. And it was a very young group, and I expected to get some feedback saying, oh, well, you know, this General Assembly thing is, you know, is, you know, for the birds, and we need to be doing something differently. They were so excited with ideas and talking about how they love their church and planning to gather. I think one of the things we've got to do is ensure that the generations that are behind the three of us see place for themselves to lead within the church. And I think where I'm seeing more presence of men is not even so much in my own generation as it is in the millennials and X and Y. And I think that's where the real hope was. If we lose that generation, male or female, we're in real trouble. But I'm looking at that room in my mind's eye, and there were lots of young men who were in that room. I have a son who is about to be 30 in August and engaged to be married. And I always joke and say, I know that I don't look that old, but I am well old enough to have a 30-year-old son. But just watching his response to my ministry as he's grown up, for him to be able to say, my mom really cares about inclusion in the church. My mom cares about justice. And he went through a phase of being a PK where, you know, they're not always excited about being in church. And he said to me just a few weeks ago, man, I wish you were pastoring again. Because that's where I'd want to be in church. Right. And so I'm seeing his friends that he grew up with turning more towards spiritual resources in this moment. So I think there's a real opportunity that we need to seize to ensure that the church stands up and really meets their expectations and says that we care about the world that they will inherit and that we want to give them place to lead it and be in it. I think my generation, maybe not so much. And I think, you know, disciples, women will tell you the women have always been there, whether they were in charge or not. They were the undergirding. But yeah, my hope is with this next generation. And I hope that during my term, I can help make space for some of us that need to kind of step back and maybe even move off the stage so that new voices and new stories get to take precedence. And I see a lot of younger men, so I'm hopeful about that.
So let me ask a follow-up question to that. In what way should we be investing our resources in supporting and nurturing those younger generations? And I absolutely agree with you. Getting off the stage is one of them. Alex and I were talking about that before you came on, is how mm-hmm. we still have a number of the younger boomers in leadership roles now. And is it time for them to exit stage left or right? And but anyway, back to your question. Where would you think is the best use of our resources? Not in building institutions. I don't think that's it. So what would you recommend to us?
Well, I think, and I know this is close to your heart, Greg, is just spiritual growth and development. I think that it's always, you know, some of that soft stuff, right, that men have not always been as open to talk about publicly. But I grew up as the granddaughter of a pastor who did Bible study. I am married to somebody who I think is challenges me always in terms of my own spiritual practice and is really involved in that. And I'm seeing these younger leaders, they need that kind of support, right? They've got the fire, they want to do new stuff, and they want to get out there and be for justice, and they've got great programmatic ideas and all sorts of things that they want to implement. And I think when they hit bumps in the road, such as we're going through right now, they begin to realize that the things that grandma or mom and dad told you about, you know, your spiritual practices and your spiritual life, or even the things that you tell yourself and you tell your congregation are important, or you tell your family are important, are really, really important. And I think the more space that we make for men to engage in context and ways that are comfortable for men to do that, I being a woman, I don't know what those are, but I do know that as a pastor, I saw people become more engaged with Bible study than I thought. Simply, maybe it was making it more accessible or not making people feel like they had to learn Hebrew and Greek in order to engage, but that they could talk about real issues, real problems, and give people a chance to speak. But I think men need a safe space in which to speak, just like women do. And they need relationship just like women. And I think if disciples men can continue to do that kind of work, I think it's really important. I also think it could be really exciting to see disciples men engage in some collaborative advocacy around issues that men feel are important in their community. And I think giving those two sides of our beings, right? Head and heart, the things that we know are important in our world and the things that we know are close to our spirits, making sure that we can feed the whole person in that way so that people see that being a part of this group matters. It's not just that I come and I pray and I feel good, but wow, we're actually going to do some stuff that we're organized here together. It makes a difference if we show up, you know, in the world. One of the reasons I've been so vocal about supporting the Poor People's Campaign is not just because it's William Barber, who's the leader and he's a disciples minister, and we all have such admiration and respect for what he's doing, but it is one way in which we can join with a whole bunch of other people and say that we care about these things. That, yeah, you know, if people sign on to June 20th, it matters. If we were able to be in D.C., it would matter. As many people, if the March on Washington had only had 500 people there, right, it would be a footnote in history. If only 20,000 people had shown up to hear Marian Anderson in 1939, that would have been, you know, a footnote. But, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of people out there. And so when we can join together in efforts where we not only are helping the things that we care about, but also, you know, from my perspective, amplifying the voices of disciples and the presence of disciples to say, I've been asking the regions, how many people do you think are going to be there? I want to be able to tell Dr. Barber, do you know that over X number of disciples were registered? So we were there. We were present. And that for me is what I hear people saying. Yeah, thanks for showing up. Thanks for being there. Disciples want to show up and be there, and we want to have an impact. So I think head and heart may be a good way to think about it. That we, and Greg, I know both of those things are close to your heart, and that's why you're doing the work with Disciples Men. But I think collaborative advocacy between Disciples Men and other parts of our church can amplify our disciples' public presence and our voice for things that hopefully men of all generations care about in the world.
Well, I know Alex and I both noted that.
Yes, I was definitely I've been taking notes this whole time. I'm filling up post-it notes on my desk, so I've got work to do when we get done. You hit on a couple things, Terry, that are near and dear to my heart as well. The collaboration and advocacy. I've said for years, I've served this church. I just celebrated my 14th anniversary of being installed here. Awesome. Past weekend. But through that time, I said, we are a church, disciples are a church for today. I mean, our time is now, because we're built on this idea of relational collaboration, of as you said, the self-governing, you know, but still around the same table. We are a time, we're a church that's built, I think, for this time. And as hard as these growing pains have been between COVID and this upsurge in awareness of the systemic racism that plagues our society and our church, as hard as that has been, it is a point in time that I think allows us to speak. And to do more than speak, but to put some real action into what we're preaching and proclaiming as the good news, as the gospel of Jesus Christ, crucified and risen. And I just want to start by saying I'm really appreciative of the hard work that I've seen coming out of you and your office during these times of really providing us in ministry at the local level with some tools, resources, things to reflect on, an opportunity. you've been a real pastor to the pastors, offering us an opportunity to sit with you virtually and to just share our hearts and to pray for us. That's been deeply appreciated, and certainly has not gone unnoticed by pastors that I know, and even by our congregations. I'm starting to hear some of that from my little church, seeing them share posts from that you would make on Facebook or OGM mm-hmm. makes on Facebook.
That's awesome.
So I want to thank you for that. And you said something that really caught my attention earlier, that the idea of we've had these grandiose plans, but we haven't known how to get there. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you'd speak a little more to that. What plans might or what actions might we take that are most helpful of moving us towards that beloved community?
Beloved community, that phrase of Dr. King, and our whole denomination was born, in the aftermath of King's assassination. We were talking about reconciliation ministry before, in the earlier 60s. The merger agreement between the National Christian Missionary Convention and what was then the International Convention of Disciples of Christ, the white and the black church, so to speak, coming together. And really at the impetus of the black church saying, hey, guys, this is who we say we want to be. So why don't we just be one church? Why don't we actually, try to live into it? And then, we're so careful, as Greg was saying, about who has authority and who has what. So there are all these inflections and complexities that have to go into the arrangements of the organization so that, no one is telling anybody else what to do and everybody's, kind of at the table. And I think that the real hope for me is that we've been focused so much on our structures and being sure that everybody's at the table. And sometimes having every single piece of every single organization at the table isn't the most efficient way to operate.
Right.
For example, one of the sticking points on the most recent redaction, I guess, of the general board or reduction of the general board was that there were regional ministers who said every single regional minister must be there. This crop of regional ministers is like, we're totally fine.
Good.
Not all of us being in the room, because it's not me who has to be represented. It's my particular lens and perspective.
Right.
And if we could focus less on that kind of stuff, like it's important. Representation is important it's a justice issue. Mm-hmm. But not every single person who belongs to a group or perspective needs to be in the room.
Right.
And there has to at some point be a level of trust that my compadres are actually going to be thinking with the good of the whole church in mind and not just my particular interests.
Right.
So we've gotten really wrapped up and I've seen that conundrum even as we're thinking about, well, let's look at how decisions should be made. What decisions get made at General Assembly and what decisions get made at General Board versus the Administrative Committee versus regions, and is that all still really working for us? And I think maybe our founders and foremothers and forefathers gave us a whole lot of flexibility in how we imagine that. And we could probably make some changes there. But I think our real energy will be in our collaborating to make a change in the world. One of our consultants, David Hooker, said to us, given what I know of what you guys believe and how you've even ordered your world, he said, every disciples church should be a mega church. You guys should have no problem attracting, and we are the church for today. We had some communications people that were working with us from DC. They're like, you guys are the most relevant group of people in the United States right now in terms of churches. I'm like, we know this. We know this. And so one of the things I think that's hurting is because we say, here we are, we're this, but how are we leveraging that understanding to make a difference in the world? And it's not just the idea that we have a welcome and open table. And sadly, some of us still don't really want to have a truly open and welcome table. Mm-hmm. I remember when my congregation went through the discernment process to become an open and affirming congregation. And this is an older congregation. I was like one of the youngest adults in the building, right? And this is an older congregation. It was a unanimous vote to go that way. Why? Because we found out their children, their grandchildren, their nieces and nephews, families were able to technically sort of come out in the room and talk about family members whom they deeply loved, but they were afraid to talk about them for fear that other people would condemn those family members. One of our elders, their granddaughter, who had come out and gone through a really difficult time, came to church, and we had taken, which I had a picture to show you how beautifully this. It wasn't just a regular rainbow flag. It was separate pieces of fabric that formed the rainbow. So it had a lot of texture and depth to it. And the way it was sort of swagged across the chancel behind this huge cross that hung suspended from the chancel area. This young woman walked in and started crying when she saw it. Yeah. And then she posted a picture of this on her Facebook page and said, "This is my grandma's church. Isn't this cool?"
Yeah.
Now, what did it hurt any of us to, I mean, we got families out there, and the idea that Jesus would ever stand for not welcoming people into the building, let alone to the table. That's just one example where doing something,
yes,
begins to impact and ripple families. That young woman and her mom started going to church again. And they had, you know, they hadn't been in church. My son, as he became of age and started to, you know, my husband served a different church, and he had kind of grown up more in that church than he had. He was baptized in the Disciples Church, kind of went back and forth between the two traditions. He would say, "Am I going to mommy's church or daddy's church?" That kind of thing. But when I hear him and his fiance, her parents go to a different denomination. They want me to do their ceremony, not just because I'm his mom, but because the things I believe in and what I do with those things is, so people kind of want to see, what are you going to do? When we see disciples' chalices everywhere in these marches, people say, "Oh, those are the people who are willing not just to say, we're a pro-reconciling anti-racist church, but we're putting our feet to our faith and we're out there and we're doing things." Or if we're the ones in the neighborhood who are doing even food pantries and clothing drives, and you know, some churches that were, UCC did a whole thing about canceling medical debt, right?
Right.
They got this huge bump, and it's because people are like, "Oh my God, you're helping people with like real stuff, like medical debt."
Yeah.
So doing things together and really beyond the common thing, even food pantries matter. My church had a back to school fair where we served over 700 people every summer, not just for school supplies, but for fun and haircuts and physicals and all kinds of other community services. And those kids came back year. We saw some kids literally growing up because we were the church that did that stuff. And the mom's like, "Well, I know that I can go to that church and get some support." We had a few families who joined. And in fact, some families who started giving to the fair because they had been helped by it. And once they were back on their feet, they wanted to do something different. So lots of different ways about what we do. And worship is fine. In worship, we're never going to all be the same on worship. And that's important. But Jesus fed people before he taught them.
Right.
Yes. And when he healed, they followed him because of what he did. And what he did got their attention. Then they paid attention to what he said. So I think this action, and some people go, "Oh, not political, not justice." Well, what else are we doing?
Right.
We're followers of Jesus Christ. What else are we doing? Singing hymns and having communion is simply not enough if we're trying to change the world.
That's really a message I think that does resonate with, as we've talked about, resonates with the younger generation. I know my kids who are now both adults, barely, so they're in that, you know, late teens, early 20s. They're looking to change the world. They want to do something. My daughter has had some very, we've had some very impassioned conversations after the murder of George Floyd about how do we move forward from here? And we don't necessarily see eye to eye. She might be more radical than I am. And that's okay. That passion, I think we've talked about ways that we can support that passion.
And I think the heart is so important because we do these things because we're followers of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
There are lots of organizations that you could join. They're going to be active for justice and all kinds of groups you can be in, from the Kiwanis to the Lions, Junior League, NAACP, Urban League. You can do a lot of things. But we are followers of Jesus Christ, right? So we always have to, I think, lead with our understanding of the love that Jesus commands us to not just have for our neighbor. You know, it's one thing to say, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Some of us aren't as healthy as we need to be in taking care of ourselves or even loving ourselves. But when Jesus says, love one another as I have loved you, then all of a sudden the bar goes like really way up. Because his love was a really radical, you know, talk about inclusive, active kind of love. And I hope that people can see that being a Christian frees you to do that work. If you care about the world, there's no better person to follow than Jesus. I mean, if you want to do those kinds of things, then your spirit gets fed, your soul gets fed, and you also do some good things for the world. So I think we also as church have to remind people that we're here because of Jesus. We're here because he said, this is what we should be doing. And that to me is the most powerful motivation. And that's what should also set us apart. So if the church is silent in this time, you know, heaven help us. I don't know what we say to future generations. I don't think we get this time back.
Yeah.
We don't get this back if we mess this up. We don't get it back.
Yeah, no, I think you're just right.
Yeah, I would agree, and I see our time has probably elapsed as much as I'd love for this conversation to keep on going for a lot longer. Terry, we can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your extraordinarily busy schedule to be with us, and I hope you know that you have the support of Disciples Men, and you know we're in your corner, and we're going to continue to explore ways for us to be your partners in ministry, and to do our part. And
absolutely,
just know you are in our prayers. Our love is always with you, and we are so grateful for the leadership you're providing us at a very, very challenging time, but also a time that is ripe with a lot of promise. And thank you so much, Alex.
I agree, Terry. Thank you so much for your time today. It has been a great conversation, and maybe we'll try to steal some more of your time somewhere down the road and talk a little bit more. It has been great.
Oh, thank you. This has just been great. I've enjoyed the conversation, and Disciples Men, just know that I love you and always looking for ways to collaborate. And as always, grateful to, I get to spend a lot of time working with Greg, and I'm grateful for that. So he's retired, but still active, still very active. So we're grateful for your leadership, and good to talk with you too, Alex.
Once again, our profound thanks to the General Minister and President of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ in the United States and Canada, Terry Hoard Owens, for taking time to talk with us on the Disciples Men podcast. We hope you'll join us for another edition of the Disciples Men podcast in the near future.
Our special thanks to our good friend, the Reverend Dr. Dean Phelps, for providing the special music of this podcast. You can discover more of Dean's music at deanphelpsmusic.com. And you can learn more about the ministry of Disciples Men on Facebook and through discipleshomemissions.org.